the natural tendency, I think, for all of us to sort of shy away from or avoid things that we find confusing or intimidating, something that maybe is a little scary for us to mess with. They were up here messing with this computer earlier. I'll tell you, these young people with these computers, they just go flying through that stuff. I'm of the opinion, you know, if I touch that button, I'm going to lose everything on this computer. And the world, the world may come to an end if I touch that button. And so there's just a sort of a natural tendency to avoid. I give you another example. I know some of you guys probably were like me in the day we worked on our own cars. And it used to be I felt like I could do a lot of things to a car. I understood a little bit about that. But these days, when I raise the hood on an automobile, I don't even know what I'm looking at. You know, I don't even know what that stuff is. I have a potential conspiracy theory to share with you. Is it possible that all those hoses and wires and belts that are under the hood, they don't even do anything? They're just there to make it look scary, you know, so that you won't try to work on it yourself and that you'll have to take it back to the dealership and pay their big fees in order to get it worked on. I don't know, just something to think about. But what I'm suggesting to you is we stay away from things that are confusing to us or intimidating to us. Tonight, we want to talk about a book of the Bible that is in that category. We want to talk about the book of Revelation. And I think a lot of people are really scared of Revelation. Oh, you know, maybe you suggest we're going to study the book of Revelation in our adult Bible. Oh, not Revelation. Oh, no. I don't want to study Revelation. That's confusing. I don't understand it. I can't figure it out. And so people just avoid it and maybe don't even read it. And I think that's such a big mistake, because the book of Revelation is an important part of God's message to mankind, and he wants us to understand it. And so tonight what I want to do is share with you just what I think are some simple keys that will help us understand the book of Revelation. We're not going to go into an in-depth study of any of the particular passages, but we are just going to try to suggest some things that will help us when we read the book of Revelation and study it to help get from it the important message that God wants us to know. So five keys to understanding the book of Revelation. That's what we want to talk about tonight. Stop here for just a minute to add words of welcome to those that Don already mentioned. He said something that reminded me. He said, "We thank you for your presence tonight." I almost always say that. And one of my grandsons, I think he was probably 5 or 6 years old, and he said to his mom one Sunday, he said, "Who's bringing all these presents to Papa?" He says he always gets up there and says, "Thanks for your presence." And he said, "Who's giving Papa all those presents?" Obviously, that's not what we're saying, but it is in a sense a present to be able to come together and worship God. It is a real blessing, and we're glad that you're here tonight to be a part of it. We appreciate your special effort and your diligence to come out on a weeknight to join together in the study of God's Word. It shows your commitment and your conviction, and we appreciate you for that. Thanks to you all for being here tonight. Don already said, if there's any question, even any potential disagreement with anything that we say tonight, please bring that to our attention so we can straighten that out. We want to understand God's Word, and we believe that we can. Okay, so how are we going to approach the book of Revelation? Well, the first thing that I want to suggest to you is that you have to realize that the book of Revelation was written to a specific audience of people. In any communication that we do, it's important to know who is speaking and to whom they are speaking, because that makes a big difference in what the message means. I'll give you an example of this. When my daughter Sarah was still at home, if I had said to her, "You go to your room, you clean that mess up, you don't come out of there till everything is spick and span and in its place," and I mean it. If it was understood that I, as the father, was speaking to my daughter in that tone of voice, well, okay, you know, that's all right. If my wife Cindy intercepted that communication and thought I was speaking to her in that tone of voice, we probably have a different problem on our hands. And so who is speaking and to whom we are speaking, that's always important in any communication. And that's true here in the book of Revelation. The book of Revelation was written to real Christians living in the first century. In fact, we find that at the beginning of the book in chapter 1, verse 4, John, to the seven churches which are in Asia, grace be unto you. And so this message was written to seven congregations of God's people that were in the geographical area identified as Asia. A lot of times in our Bible studies, we will call this Asia Minor. It is the area that today is in the modern day country of Turkey. These seven churches were located in that region. In fact, in verse 11 there of chapter 1, they are identified. What thou seest, write in a book, send it unto the seven churches which are in Asia, unto Ephesus, and unto Smyrna, and unto Pergamos, and unto Thyatira, and unto Sardis, and unto Philadelphia, and unto Laodicea. So there's the identifier, right? Those are the people who are being addressed with the message of this book. That's at the start of the book. And at the end of the book, it's reiterated to us in chapter 22, verse 16, I, Jesus, have sent mine angel to testify unto you these things in the churches. Now, here's the point that we want to draw from that. Since this message was written to those seven churches in Asia, to real first century Christians who lived in that area, then any interpretation which we would put upon this message that would prove meaningless to them probably is the wrong interpretation. You follow me? So think about this. You remember back in the 90s when the first Gulf War broke out? Saddam Hussein in Iraq had invaded Kuwait. And the United States and a number of allied nations were assembling their troops to drive Saddam Hussein out of Kuwait. Well, in the run-up to that, all of these self-pronounced prophecy experts on radio and TV were saying, oh, well, this is the book of Revelation come to fruition. This is exactly what the book of Revelation is talking about. We see it coming to pass right before our very eyes. Well, it wasn't, was it? In fact, that first Gulf War turned out to be a fairly minor skirmish in the annals of military history. It only lasted a few days. Even in our time, it's going to fade pretty rapidly into history. But think about this. If that's what the book of Revelation was about, why would that have been meaningful to these first century Christians? How could a military exercise in 2,000 years later have been a meaningful message to people who were living in the first century? You see what I'm saying? So if the message, who's speaking? To whom are they speaking? And whatever meaning you attach to this, make sure it would have had some significance to them. One way to think about it is when you're reading the book of Revelation, sort of put on your first century reading glasses. Imagine that you are a Christian in Ephesus or Thyatira, and you're reading this message. What do you take away from it? What message do you get? It has to mean something to them, or it's the wrong understanding of the book. Okay? That's a simple first observation. Our second observation is this, that you need to understand that these Christians to whom the book was written, they were dealing with a specific set of circumstances. Their circumstance, in a word, was persecution. These people were being severely persecuted. And so the book of Revelation was intended as a message of hope and consolation to these suffering Christians. Notice the kind of terminology that's used. In chapter 2 at verse 10, fear none of those things which thou shalt suffer. Behold, the devil shall cast some of you into prison that ye may be tried, and ye shall have tribulation 10 days. Be thou faithful unto death, and I will give thee a crown of life. Notice the Lord was aware of what they were dealing with. Things were bad. The people were already suffering. But notice, there's some future tense verbiage here. The devil shall cast some of you into prison. Ye shall have tribulation 10 days. And so the idea was, the Lord understood it was bad. It was going to continue for a while. I don't think anybody thinks that he meant a literal 10 days. In fact, the message from John couldn't even gotten into their hands in a 10-day period. That was obviously meant to mean just for a short time. This is not going to be forever. This persecution will go on indefinitely. But it's bad. And it's going to get worse. There's going to be more of it before it ends. In chapter 6, verse 9, John says, I saw under the altar the souls of them which were slain for the word of God and for the testimony which they had. How bad was this persecution? Some were even dying. Christians were dying under this severe persecution. In chapter 7, verse 14, these are they that came out of great tribulation and have washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. Notice the kind of terminology is used here, tribulation. That kind of terminology denotes the great struggle that these people were dealing with. That's what was going on. And as we read the book of Revelation, we need to keep that in mind. Written to those first century Christians to help them in dealing with the persecution that they were suffering. Now, another thing that we've got to grasp is that the book of Revelation deals with a specific timetable. And it's very important for us to know this. This is really going to affect what interpretation we place upon the message. I think if you were to talk to people, if you just did a survey on the streets of Akron and you asked people, what's the book of Revelation about? Probably a lot of people wouldn't have a clue, but the ones who did have any idea would say it was written to talk about future events. It was written to foretell future events, and that would be a true statement. But of course, the big question is, how far out in the future? In chapter 1 of Revelation, verse 9, John was told, write the things which thou hast seen, and the things which are, and the things which shall be hereafter. Now think about that for a minute. Write about the things that thou hast seen. That would be recent past events, right? So write about what you have seen. Write about the things which are. That would be current events, things going on right then. But he says also write about the things which shall be hereafter. And that's the big question mark. So obviously it was written about future events, but how far off in the future would they be? Well, we don't have to wonder or speculate about the answer to that question. These things which shall be hereafter, how far hereafter? How far out in the future? Well, chapter 1, verse 1, I know many of you are aware of this and you've studied this and made this point probably to others. But chapter 1, verse 1 is such an important verse in understanding the message of the book of Revelation. Notice, the revelation of Jesus Christ which God gave unto him to show unto his servants things which must shortly come to pass. And he sent and signified it by his angel and to his servant John. There's the key phrase, right? Things which must shortly come to pass. Okay, here we are approximately 2,000 years later. Not quite, but nearly 2,000 years later. And they haven't. You want us to believe that the events in the book of Revelation haven't happened yet? When John said that they were things which must shortly come to pass, but they haven't come to pass yet in 2,000 years? That doesn't seem to make sense, does it? Doesn't seem to fit with the description that's given there. In fact, in verse 3, he said, blessed is he that readeth and they that hear the words of this prophecy and keep those things which are written therein, for the time is at hand. What John was writing about involved things that were just about ready to take place back then, not now. Back in the first century, not in the 21st century. You see it? Things which must shortly come to pass. Again, these statements are at the start of the book. We need to take them to heart. And John concludes this book with a similar statement in the last chapter, chapter 22, verse 10. He saith unto me, seal not the sayings of the prophecy of this book, for the time is at hand. So at both the beginning and end of the book, we're told this is talking about things that are going to happen in the near future, not way off in the far distant future. These things are about to take place. We got to remember that. We won't go to the book of Daniel to make this contrast, but it's sort of an interesting thing. In the book of Daniel, Daniel was prophesying about things that were hundreds of years off in the future. And Daniel was told, seal up the prophecy of the book, for the time is not yet. But John was told here in Revelation, don't seal up the prophecies of this book, for the time is at hand. And so all of that points to the idea that the book of Revelation primarily dealing about things that were going to happen right there in the immediate near future. We believe that the vast majority of things that are mentioned in the book of Revelation have already taken place. We are not waiting for their fulfillment in our day and time. Now, we do understand that in the last chapters of the book of Revelation, there's a description of final judgment and the end of the world. We even talked about that in our lesson on Sunday when we talked about the book of life and the final judgment that will be had. Obviously, we do not believe those things have happened yet. But in regards to the vast majority of things that John was shown, the prophecy that he made, these things were going to happen in the near term, not way off in our time. And so all of these people who are telling us, oh, we're seeing the book of Revelation come to fruition in our lifetime. We're seeing all those events. Now we see them unfolding. They're wrong, right? Because the book of Revelation wasn't describing those sort of things that would happen in our lifetime. We need to understand that the book of Revelation has a specific style of writing. You don't have to be a great Bible scholar to recognize that there's something different about the book of Revelation just in the very casual reading of it. There's a lot of symbols, a lot of figures are used. Things are used to represent other things. There's a special significance that's assigned to colors and numbers and so forth. The book of Revelation uses a lot of highly symbolic and figurative language. And again, you can pick up on that very quickly when you start reading the book of Revelation. But again, we are tipped off to be on guard for this. We are tipped off to be aware that this is the way the book will be written. In that very first verse again, chapter 1, verse 1, the revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave unto him to show unto his servants things which must shortly come to pass. And he sent and signified it by his angel unto his servant John. I believe that expression, he sent and signified, is spoken in signs, symbolic, figurative language. So please understand that. When you're reading the book of Revelation, it uses this symbolic or figurative language. And you know, that's not real unusual. We do that ourselves on a regular, daily basis. Why do we use figurative language? Well, typically we use it for emphasis. We use it to really emphasize something. I'm going to tell you, it rained hard at my house the other day. It rained cats and dogs. You ever heard somebody use that expression? It rained cats and dogs, really? You mean cats and dogs were literally falling out of the sky? No. And you wouldn't even begin to think that, right? You understand that's just a figurative expression that's used for emphasis. And we use that kind of figurative language all the time. As someone explained a figure to me recently. I didn't know where it came from. I use it all the time, but I hadn't ever discovered where it came from. You ever use the expression lock, stock, and barrel? You know, he doesn't own that place anymore. He sold it, lock, stock, and barrel. You know what that's? You know where that comes from? That comes from gunsmithing. It's about guns. The lock is the hammer and trigger mechanism in the gun. Lock, stock. You know, the stock is the part you put up against your shoulder. And you know what the barrel of a gun is, right? Lock, stock, and barrel. That's all there is to a gun. It's the whole of the thing. It's the entirety of it. Now, like I said, I used that figure of speech for a long time, never even knew until someone explained that's what that means, lock, stock, and barrel. But we use those kind of expressions in order to emphasize something. If we were coming into the assembly here tonight and one of the young mothers said, the kids were like a pack of wild Indians today. Really? Wild Indians? And some of the mothers are saying, now listen, that's literal. I mean that literally. They were really like wild Indians today. But we use expressions, don't we? We use figurative expressions to emphasize things. Well, the book of Revelation does that. As we said, we're tipped off in the first verse to be on the lookout for that sort of thing. Now, here's the problem. If a statement is figurative and you try to force a literal interpretation, you're going to get in trouble every time. Right? Cats and dogs, rain cats and dogs. Try to force that to be literal and it's just crazy. It doesn't even make any sense at all, right? If you take a figurative expression and you try to force a literal meaning on that figurative expression, you're going to come up with trouble all the time. And unfortunately, that's what people do with the book of Revelation, and they try to force literal meanings on figurative expressions. Let me give you a couple examples of this sort of thing. Have you ever spoken with the Jehovah's Witnesses? I imagine almost everybody here has at one time or another, because the Jehovah's Witnesses are very active and evangelistic in their cause. I think we have to admire their dedication to their cause, but I think they're really wrong on lots of things. In talking with the Jehovah's Witnesses, have you ever heard their explanation of the 144,000? That's one of their unique doctrines. The Jehovah's Witnesses believe that there will be only 144,000 people who will go to heaven. And in fact, they don't mean that just approximately. They mean that exactly. There will be exactly 144,000 people who will go to heaven. Now, for the rest of those who are righteous, the Lord is going to refashion planet Earth. He's going to put it back into the condition that it was in when Adam and Eve lived in the Garden of Eden. And so the rest of the righteous, as they say, will inherit the earth. And so that's what's going to happen. But only 144,000 will go to heaven. And someone says, well, where in the world did they get that anyway? Well, they got it from the book of Revelation. Look with me in Revelation chapter 7. Here's one of the two places where it's mentioned. And again, the number is there for sure, but is it literal or figurative? In Revelation chapter 7, verse 4, John says, I heard the number of them which were sealed, and they were sealed, 144,000 of all the tribes of the children of Israel. Of the tribe of Judah were sealed 12,000. Of the tribe of Reuben were sealed 12,000. Of the tribe of Gad were sealed 12,000. And it just goes on and lists the tribes, and 12,000 each tribe. 12 tribes, 12,000 from each tribe. That's 144,000, right? Now, here's what I'd like to encourage you to do this. Next time you have a chance to study with Jehovah's Witnesses, and by all means, take up their offer to study. If they'll study with you, study with them. And ask them about the 144,000. Get them on record first. Is the number literal? Yes. Yes, it is. Absolutely exact. Okay, then ask them, will all of those that are in the 144,000 be literally physical Jews of one of the tribes of Israel? No, they don't believe that. They do not believe that. So they got a dilemma here, you see. They want the number to be literal, but right within the same description, they want to turn the explanation into something figurative. I'm going to tell you, you're going to have to decide which way you want that. You can't have it both ways. They're wrong about making it literal. It is figurative, right? And it's a figurative number and it's a figurative description. The number is a number that suggests fullness or completeness. 12 is a number of fullness or completeness in the symbolism of Scripture, not just in the book of Revelation, but elsewhere. And so 12 times 12 is 144,000. 12 times 12 is 144. Times 1,000, 144,000 is a number of fullness and completeness. I really think that's what it literally means. And it was never what it figuratively means, and it was never intended to be taken literally. Now, there's another place where the number is mentioned. Go over into chapter 14. In Revelation 14, at verse 4, begin at verse 3. Revelation 14, verse 3, they sung, as it were, a new song before the throne and before the four beasts and the elders, and no man could learn that song but the 144,000 which were redeemed from the earth. These are they which were not defiled with women, for they are virgins. These are they that follow the Lamb whithersoever he goeth. These were redeemed from among men, being the first fruits unto God and to the Lamb. So ask the Jehovah's Witnesses again. Concerning the 144,000, is it literal? Yes, they will say. Do you believe then that every one of the 144,000 will be a male virgin? Because that's what the verse says, right? If it's literal, then let's take it literally. And all 144,000 must be male virgins. Do you believe that? I know this because I've challenged them on this. They will say, no, they don't believe that. They believe it'll be men and women alike that will make up the 144,000. Again, they got the same problem, right? They're just flip-flopping at their whim between literal and figurative. I think this is figurative. And again, you're going to get into a big problem if you try to force a literal meaning. I don't know how much time. Well, we might run out of time. Let me give you real quickly one more illustration. You talk to anybody who's a premillennialist? I'm sure you have, because almost all of our religious friends are premillennialists these days. They believe that the Lord is coming back to establish an earthly reign for 1,000 years. There's so much to the theory of premillennialism that you can't, I mean, where'd they get that anyway? Well, they got that from the book of Revelation. It's the only place I know that mentions anything like that. Chapter 20. Turn over quickly to chapter 20. I saw an angel come down from heaven having the key of the bottomless pit and a great chain in his hand. And he laid hold on that dragon, the old serpent, which is the devil and Satan, and bound him 1,000 years and cast him into the bottomless pit and shut him up. Skip down to verse 4. I saw thrones, and they sat upon them, and judgment was given unto them. And I saw the souls of them that were beheaded for the witness of Jesus, and for the word of God, and which had not worshipped the beast, neither his image, neither had received his mark upon their foreheads or in their hands, and they lived and reigned with Christ 1,000 years. Now look at that passage, and if you underline things, you might want to underline something. This is a passage that just screams out to us, figurative, 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 not literal, not literal. Verse 1. The angel had the key to the bottomless pit. Really? A bottomless pit? Could there literally be a bottomless pit? Dave, you could dig a real deep hole, but I don't care how deep you dig it, there's a bottom to it, right? Any literal pit has a bottom to it. This pit has no bottom. Couldn't be literal, right? It has to be figurative. And then he talks about a chain that's going to be used to bind up Satan. Is there a literal chain that you could use to bind up Satan? Well, Satan's a spirit being, right? You can't bind up a spirit being with a literal chain. This has to be figurative, figurative, figurative. But then when they get to the 1,000 years, they want that to be literal. Same problem that the Jehovah's Witnesses have. They're trying to flip-flop within the same text between literal and figurative, and that's going to lead you to mistake. When you try to force a literal meaning on a figurative text, you're going to end up with confusion every time. When you have a chance to study with them, Don can give you all kind of good info on premillennialism. He's really studied that doctrine. I like to ask them, the people who will reign, the saints who will reign with Jesus during the 1,000 years, do you believe that they all must be martyrs, but not just any kind of martyr? Only martyrs who have been beheaded, because that's what verse 4 says. I saw the souls of them that were beheaded for the witness of Jesus. And so they have to be a martyr, but a special kind of martyr. Burned at the stake? No. Fed to the lions? No. You know, you have to have your head cut off. And only those who were beheaded can reign with Christ during the 1,000 years. You believe that? No, I don't believe that. See? You see the problem? All right, we're going to have to hurry on here. So understand the specific style of writing, because if we're not careful with that, we're going to get into trouble every time. All right, finally, understand the purpose of the book. The purpose of the book, again, as we said earlier, was written to these persecuted Christians. They were being imprisoned. Many were being imprisoned. Some were being killed, martyred for the cause. They were scared. They were frightened. And this message was written to offer them comfort and consolation. I'll do this as fast as I can, but I want you to try to imagine something. I want you to really use your imagination. I'm going to really test your imaginative powers here. I want you to imagine something. So you get home tonight after services and you get to bed and you fall off into that deep sleep. You know that very first part of that deep sleep? I mean, you're just out. And the phone rings. The phone right there beside your bed rings. And so you fumble around, you reach over there and you pick it up. Hello. And the person on the other end does not even identify themselves. But you recognize them. It's one of the other members of the church here at Brown Street. Did you hear what happened? What happened? What are you talking about? Did you hear about the elders? Did you hear about Dale and Gary? Dale and Gary? What? Dale and Gary are in jail. In jail? You got to be kidding me. Why are they in jail? What'd they do? Well, the police came around and arrested them tonight. They said they know that they're leaders of a church in Akron. And they're going around trying to round them all up. They're throwing them in jail. And they're looking for the rest of the elders. Joe, they're looking for the rest of the elders. They're throwing them in jail. And the phone goes dead. And you're still sort of in a half foggy daze, you know. You haven't really totally woken up. I mean, you can't, what's going on here anyway, you know? And before you can get that sorted out in your mind, the phone rings again. And it's another member of the church here at Brownsburg. Again, they're in a panic. Did you hear what happened? Well, yeah, I heard about Dale and Gary. Not Dale and Gary. Did you hear about Don? Don? What about Don? Don is dead. Don is dead. Yeah, the army came to his house tonight, drug him out of bed, lined him up against the garage wall, and shot him. They said they knew he was a preacher, and they're killing all the preachers. Can you imagine that? You can't even imagine that, can you? That is so far removed from our experience that you can't even begin. That seems so far from possibility that we can't even come close to imagining such a thing as that. But I'll tell you, that's exactly what was happening to these Christians in the first century. Those are the kind of things they were dealing with on an ongoing basis. You think you'd be frightened if you began to get calls like that? Well, of course. You think they were frightened? Absolutely so. They needed to hear from God. And that's what this book of Revelation was about. The book of Revelation was written to offer comfort and assurance to these persecuted Christians. The book of Revelation has God in control. God is still in control. And he was aware of what was going on, and God would be victorious. Someone has suggested, and I think it's really a good way to think about it. If you want a two-word summary of the book of Revelation, the two-word summary is this: God wins. God wins. That's what the book of Revelation says. There's a great struggle, and it's been going on since the Garden of Eden, really, and it continues to our day. There's a great struggle between good and evil. How's it turn out? Who wins? God wins. God wins this great struggle between good and evil. God will be victorious. And if you're on his side, you will be on the winning side. The book of Revelation shows Jesus on his throne. It shows the beasts destroyed. And by the way, don't be thrown off by those beasts in the book of Revelation, the land beast and the sea beast. Those are just agents that Satan was using to persecute God's people. A lot of people think that the beasts were probably organized religion and governmental opposition against God's kingdom. But the beasts were just agents that Satan was using to persecute Christians. And it shows those beasts destroyed. The devil himself is defeated. Martyred Christians are seen alive around the throne of God, praising him. God wins. Look at chapter 17, verse 14. These shall make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb shall overcome them, for he is Lord of lords and King of kings, and they that are with him are called and chosen and faithful. And so there's the story. There's the end of the story, if you will. If you're on God's side, you will be on the winning side. And those Christians really desperately needed to hear that message. We're going to hold up right there, and we'll just make a final observation here in a minute when the children return from classes. But remember this as we're studying the book of Revelation. Again, obviously, we have not done an in-depth study of the book. But I really do think that if we keep these five principles in mind, as we go to the book of Revelation to do a more in-depth study, it'll really be helpful. Understand that it would have had to mean something to those people back then. And it was written to them as they were suffering this horribly intense persecution. They needed this comfort and consolation. Be really careful about the figurative language, because that has the potential, as it already has, obviously already has, really confuse a lot of people. Don't let the figurative language throw you out. I don't think, I'm sort of convinced that it may well be that we can never say with absolute certainty what every one of those figurative expressions in the book of Revelation means. But we don't have to be able to figure all those out. As long as we can see this big picture, I think that's what we can really take away, and it can be so helpful to us understand the purpose of the book. Thanks for your good attention to what we had to say.